Halfway to Hell by Chuck Ochelli. This is an audiobook only presentation, and it is being recorded live on the 21st day of June 2022. I have with me Bob Wilson and Chris Graves, and they are going to be my audience. Normally, we will not be broadcasting this. It'll only be available in audio form to those that subscribe and follow it as premium content. But today we'll give away the first part of it without interruption, and it'll serve as a short audio book in and of itself, but it is only the introductory section of the presentation. A lot of books start with a quote. I'll offer the one that I thought was most appropriate, and it may sound a bit odd, but makes the most sense to me. Your world is an ashtray. We burn and coil like cigarettes. The more you cry, your ashes turn to mud. Comes from the song Reflecting God by Marilyn Manson. Being thankful, well, there is a section to thank people. There is a section for acknowledgments in many books, and that's a very difficult thing for me to do. What I will say is that there are people responsible for what it is that I am able to successfully do today in an honest fashion. And the key individuals who have been most consistent over the years really number only two. And that is Michael Swanson and Patricia Braunschweiler. They have supported me as a broadcaster and podcaster now for many years. And they have not only been my financial base for survival, but they have also been two of the best friends that I've ever had. Must also mention another friend who has been very supportive in recent years, and we'll just call him Dave. I could thank a great many other people, and should actually, for a lot of the things, both woeful and celebratory, that might be presented in the book in its entirety. But instead, I'll tell you that I'm extremely thankful for three unique people on the planet who I am grateful exist. But I'm not only grateful that they exist, I'm grateful that they bear absolutely no resemblance to myself, with the exception possibly of the oldest one among them, who does on occasion resemble her father. But my three children, I am not only grateful that you exist and grateful that you have knowledge of me as your father, but I am also grateful that you have no knowledge of what it is to have lived like I have or to be me. Forward. Perhaps the strangest thing that I've ever encountered in my life is the idea that my life might even be an interesting tale to tell. For a long time, I figured there was nothing fascinating, unique. I figured that my story was common. I figured that there was no way that there could be a reason to relate most of what has gone on in my life. That started to change when I was podcasting and broadcasting, because I told a few stories and started to reckon with some of my past in direct and indirect ways. Once I did this, I recognized that I had been, for the majority of my life, a liar of sorts. I had always had to create alternate realities in order to protect different compartmentalized pieces of my life as it stood at all times. I had to separate worlds, I had to separate lifestyles, I had to keep people separate, and thus, hardly anyone who has ever entered into my life actually knows me. It's a strange position to be in, and most people don't survive more than 5 years in my universe. Whether they die, or they part of their own volition, or I send them away, everybody is here for a very limited time, and with good reason, because eventually they might learn about the things that I have created barriers and borders to restrict them from. This was done out of necessity, and this was done out of a need to survive in many cases. All of that having been said, and the fact that even women who have been my wife have not fully known who I was or where I came from, and my children indeed do not know exactly what their father's past looks like, the people that call me their friends are only vaguely aware of certain things. This isn't the strangest part of the tale that I'm about to tell. The strangest thing is that I started out in a way where, for one reason or another, it is impossible for me to relate to almost any other human being. I've studied repeatedly about the memory and the constructs that people's emotional matrices function under. I've tried to understand how individual psychology and human emotion interacts with people's behaviors, both normal and abnormal psychology, to no avail to find myself among any of the examples. The only diagnosis, or maybe more than one diagnosis, that has ever made any sort of sense certainly does not explain the oddity that is my set of function, or should I say functionality, when it comes to psychology and emotional being. I seem to be a creature who has no peer when it comes to psychology, when it comes to behavior, and that has always confused me. But I recognized it early and understood that I should keep that mostly to myself. Back to the diagnosis. Certainly someone could say that I have been depressed much of my life, and certainly others could say that I have suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. These things are true, but they do not speak to the entire function of the being that you're about to explore, or at least the history. Another thing is that this history is certainly my own. It could be discovered and researched, and you could discover, well, a whole lot of interesting facts that maybe I've decided to leave out. It could be that there is more to the story than I'm going to tell you, but this is an honest attempt to lay out all of it. I don't like discussing myself. Generally, this is not fun for me. But I think it may serve as a lesson that one could separate themselves from, learn from, and possibly identify with, at least in part now and then, and understand what is the main motivation behind sharing this particular set of experiences. I recognize that people's memories will vary, and indeed I tried to see if I could reach out to individuals to see if they remembered a lot of things that I'm going to relate here in this book, and I found that virtually no one fully remembers anything. Indeed, I would have to constantly remind them of bits and pieces, facts, all sorts of things that I had to discover for myself later on. This is a strange place to begin, where I tell you that my memory may be unique to the other memories that could be drawn upon describing this situation. But I'll tell you that more often than not, I find that my memory is exceedingly more accurate than many, many other people's. And as I reach the age of 50, I'm also exceedingly surprised to still be alive. Throughout my life, I've heard people talk about being 100 years old, discussing living to 100 years old, talking about surviving a century as if it was some magical milestone that guaranteed that one had had a complete life, that one had outlived most of the perils and pitfalls that one could inflict upon themselves or encounter by no fault of their own. Good health, be smart, avoid this or that, and you could live to be 100. I virtually accepted that 50 was my 100. And you'll find out pretty soon exactly why that is. So I said that psychology is a unique thing for me, the way it's structured. And frankly, I didn't give you a good explanation. Here's the problem. I can't. I literally do not know how to relate, in spoken word, written or otherwise, the differences between myself and almost every single other human being I've ever encountered, no matter how I've studied them. No matter how I've tried to understand them, no matter how much they've revealed to me, I seriously believe that I have a unique construct within myself, and it's not a point of pride. It's just what I accept to be. So hopefully, as we go further through this journey and I describe my life to you, you'll be able to describe exactly what kind of animal you're studying. One last thing. I will, without a doubt, have to leave just one piece of truth out, and maybe it's a couple of pieces of truth. But they would violate one of the very core principles I have if I revealed them, and they have to do with someone else losing their freedom. That I will not reveal to anyone. Every other story, every other terrible thing, every other ugly thing that I can think of is open for discussion, but I will not surrender my freedom or anyone else's for the sake of truth. Even though I've spent the past few years living the most truthful and honest life that I am capable of. See, that time when I told you that I was definitely a liar throughout a great deal of my life had to be. But through the grace of discovering what it was I probably should have been doing a lot earlier in life, I found a way to live much more truthful, much more directly, to serve those that would ask me to serve them, and to do the right thing more often than not. I guess I've already given away the end of the 50-year journey, but you might find it interesting to see exactly how we got from point A to point 50. So I guess I'll leave those things aside that need to be left aside, and we will get at some very, very dark, deep, strange, and twisted things. I hope that's a fair enough forward, and I hope that no one gets too sucked into the story to forget about who they were and who they want to be. Because those two things are what gets me up in the morning, outside of my own children, who quite frankly are the motivating factor for why it is that I record what I do, I write what I do, and I'm still willing to want to try and change the world around me. And we're back. So Bob Wilson and Chris Graves are with me, as I said at the beginning. And what we're going to do at the end. Now, normally the audiobook section will be a lot longer. And it will only be available to those people that support it. So we're going to come out with an exact framework on that. Those of you that already support the show, there'll be a discount level on it so that it'll be just a little more that you would kick in. Per month, and you're going to get a couple of audiobooks a month out of this for a few months. I'm not sure how long it'll actually run. I'm not sure how many two-hour audiobooks I'm going to have to put out, around 2 hours anyway. And I'm also going to have these guys along, or maybe some other people along, to ask questions, to make comments, talk about what it is that was just read. Although I did not read that, by the way. I just did that off the top of my head. And I had a lot more in my mind before the show started, but I got sidetracked mentally. So, but that won't happen in the future, because I actually have notes and a structure and all kinds of things for the rest of this. Anyways, like I said, Chris Graves and Bob Wilson are with me. So, I will now just let's see, who should I start with? I guess I'll start with Bob, just let him enter in whatever his thoughts are about that little piece. It wasn't very long, as I said, and didn't give a lot of description or a lot of what's going to happen here, but might have given some hints. So anyway, Bob, go ahead.
Well, it's funny, as you live your life and you're in different situations. You could start when you're in school, when you're a kid, or when you get older and, you're with older people and you're older. You're with your family, you're with friends, you're with girlfriends, and people see you in different lights and different sides of you come out. So it's funny, I thought of a quote that I heard Bob Dylan say, "I've never been able to understand the seriousness of it all, the seriousness of pride. People talk, act, live as if they're never going to die. And what do they leave behind? Nothing. Nothing but a mask. So I just thought that was interesting. You know, in different situations, you have to wear a mask to survive sometimes. Mm. And sometimes do it for a comfort level because we feel, you know, feel our weaknesses and we feel the things we feel insecure about. So we compensate by wearing a mask at different times. And I guess we spend a lot of our life doing that. And the one thing that jumped out at me as you were speaking is I had like a real serious prayer one time where I was, you know, down on my knees searching myself. And I just prayed and said, I just want to be, you know, one person. Like, I don't want to be somebody in this situation and somebody in that situation. And can you help me, you know, to please do that? And to whatever degree, I've worked at it. And you use the word grace in there. So that, to me, that's like unmerited, undeserved, unexpected favor. Yeah. So when you go into grace and acceptance, you know, it's easier to face yourself and the things that you would live life behind a mask in. But that, you know, is the thing that that hit me, you know, is most of us have to wear a mask, and sometimes for necessity and at other times for deeper reasons, sometimes good reasons and sometimes bad reasons. But I thought that was a powerful thing to say and for somebody to admit, you know, that to speak freely about it, because when people hear you speak about it, they might, you know, empathize with it or see themselves in it and then be able to do more of that themselves. But a lot of the time, as you said, I do think we go around, you know, wearing a mask. So I thought that was very deep.
See, now, here's the weird thing. Like, I'm going to be brutally honest with you, okay? I don't understand the concept of wearing a mask. And the reason why I don't understand that is because internally, you're dealing with more than one person. I don't put on a mask. I've literally got more than one section of myself that can function almost independently. You know, like I try and look at the concept of dissociative identity disorder, and I can vaguely relate to the concept of having a control system and having separate personalities within the self. And a long time ago, a psychologist I didn't take seriously tried to tell me this, that this was why I was having trouble relating to other people, is that I literally have an interchangeable set of things going on, where it's not fully actualized separate personalities, but damn near. So, you know, and that was acquired through trauma. I remember vaguely as a small child not having this. But yeah, I really hope that I'm not undermining my credibility so badly by doing this that, you know, that I render my attempts to do anything with my media presence are useless afterwards, because yeah, my mind doesn't even work like that where I've got to put on a mask or anything. There's a separate internal thing that'll come up and take care of things if need be. And yeah, I don't even see any sort of flowchart in psychological textbooks, which I've had to go through a great many. I've gone through a lot of even the current college level stuff for your second, third year psychology students and stuff like that. I can, like I said in the introduction, I can find my PTSD in there defined. I can find depression defined, but these different mindsets that border on all these other sort of definitions, I don't see one that explains what I know is in my head, what I know is in me, what I know is me. Like, I literally am not even, it sounds weird just addressing the mask thing. I don't need to put on a mask. I've got other things that'll rise to the surface of my skin when need be. So no need to put it on. It's not a costume ever. So that's kind of a weird thing. Again, I don't know how to fully articulate it. So, you know, it, like, I hear people talk about the idea of putting on a mask and you got to put on a face and you got to, and I get it. And I see people doing it and I can recognize it externally, but yeah, it's not the same thing that I would ever do. I can just call upon or not call upon parts of myself, which is weird, but you'll discover part of how that works when I start explaining some stuff that happens a little bit after. I'm a small child. As a small child, I was one thing, I think, and then that got changed. So I don't know if it was always there and just brought out, or if it's an alteration that occurred there. But it does change your perspective. It does make it so that at all times, for instance, I can be fully of more than one mindset about something. Fully developed, have conflicting opinions, and I sort it out and I articulate it with one mouth or one hand. But it's always like through a committee process before it even gets out. So always got that extra step that has to happen. I don't know. Maybe I just made it even weirder by explaining all that, Bob, but what do you think?
How much of that has to do with your survival instinct because of your past, things that you've lived through?
I think it's exactly based on, like, I think that formation was created for survival. You know, there is there is, let me put it to you this way. If you know something needs to be done, but you're not able to even stomach it to take care of it, you might have to call somebody else to deal with it. I don't. Yeah. You know,
but you have, or, and you gave up on that, or, I mean, even calling, like, if we all went through therapy at one time or another, so you did that and it didn't work for you. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, not therapy necessarily. I mean, if you were to get into the let's just go as blunt as possible here, and I'll tell you a story that I wasn't going to include in the book at all. Just real fast though.
Bonus.
Little bonus here. And I'm not going to describe all the circumstances or all the people involved, because I'm not sure if everybody's alive or dead. But, you know, let's just say that as a kid, you were in a circumstance where everything was going a certain way. And, you know, you were around people that weren't necessarily good people, but were trying to take care of you. And in the midst of an emergent circumstance, somebody tells you, well, what you got to do here is take this power drill and drill into this guy's leg and hit the femur, okay?
Wow.
Now, you're not a violent person. You're a child even. You're exposed to, maybe you've been exposed to more violence than you should have been, but you actually doing something like that is not something that you would imagine. A lot of kids might cry and run and things like this. Let's just say that internally, I could almost put that drill into somebody else's hand, and I got it done. And I literally drilled a hole in a guy's leg because I was asked to. And that might be a bit of a shocker to some people, or that's horrible, or do you have to live with it? Or the emotional memory of it is only very curious to me in that there's no emotion connected to it. There was up until the incident, but then it kind of got handed over to another part of my mind that doesn't have these issues. And
that's the kind of thing like a soldier might go through.
Once yeah,
turns in battle or something, you file it away because you have to survive.
Yeah, but it, yeah, but I didn't intentionally do that. It just emerged as needed. And even as I'm sitting here as well-rounded as I can possibly be, and quite frankly, a lot less fractured than I've ever been in my life, thanks again to the psilocybin, and that should have been in the thank you section too, is the friends who provided me with psilocybin at their own risk, whose names I would never reveal to a law enforcement person or under threat of torture, okay, who saved my life and relieved a great deal of pain by gifting me with that. No money was exchanged. They just simply did that in order to assist me, and it did. So even after reassembling myself a great deal more than I've ever been in one piece, I think throughout my entire life, I don't feel bad about that. I don't feel bad about probably a bunch of horrible things that I should feel bad about. And really, the only disturbance I have is that I've got an emptiness where an emotion should be regarding it, even though I can very much relive my memory just fine. Yeah. It's just a curious picture in my head. Now, I would not behave that way today. I probably could call upon that part of myself if needed, but it's not needed. So I don't. And I actively make a choice not to participate in those things, not because I would feel guilty or afraid or it's like that. So that's what I'm talking about, handing it over to somebody. It literally feels as though I'm handing it over to a different person, even though I know all this stuff is actually just in my head.
Well, you know, like when you reach levels of like what you had to do to survive, like some of the stuff you've shared over the time is really intense. And I guess your mind and your body and your soul, you know, go into a shutdown mode, you know, in order that we can survive. So in that way, you know, you're a survivor and you had to be a survivor. So it's not like you wanted to be put in that position, but what happened to you, in some sense, a lot of the time might have given you no real choice. Like, you have to survive. That was at the top of the pyramid.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and that you can find, you know, it's understandable how someone can go through those kind of things. And, you know, it's amazing to come out the other end and work through it, which is what you're doing. And there's an old phrase, like having the courage to stand naked, you know, and stand before people. And people, I think, try to do that to different degrees, but I think it's a courageous thing to do. And it benefits those who, you know, listen in and then apply it to themselves as well. But it sounds like, you know, from what you described to me, you're a survivor and you survived some pretty incredible, intense things.
Well, yeah, that's part of what I hope to demonstrate in the book, is that, you know, regardless of the circumstance, regardless of the judgment of others, regardless of how, you know, profane someone's actions might be and the things you've done or whatever else, that there is always the possibility of redemption, and you don't have to continuously suffer in cycles of violence, whether they are inflicted upon you by others or yourself. So overall, I mean, that's one of the main reasons that I want to actually go into this. And frankly, I thought none of it would be interesting at all, because for most of my life, I thought, well, you know, most people probably just hide that they've been through a bunch of this stuff anyway. Everybody's walking around wounded. Yeah. And they seem to be, you know, one way or another. But I find it remarkable when somebody tells me the ultimate worst thing that ever happened to me, which a lot of people do. They often want to tell me about that for some reason. It's just one of those things that comes out of people's mouths to me. This is the worst thing that I ever experienced. This is the worst thing I ever did. I don't know why, but it's like a natural thing that comes out of people to me all the time. And I always find it ironic, because almost no matter what somebody says, it's like, well, okay, I can actually relate to that. And they go, well, how could you unless you did? Well, you know, look, there's very few horrible acts that you can think of that I haven't been present for, part of, victim of, at all, right? I mean, you know, I could tell you bluntly that, you know, I've had, and this is part of why I have you here, actually, Bob.
I was trying to figure it out.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, right? is that you're one of the very 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 Christian people I know, and very very Christian people, whenever they've gotten anywhere near me, whether it was trying to assist me as a juvenile delinquent or in other circumstances, some very good people have been very very harshly judgmental with me.
Oh, big time in that circle.
And you know, not wanted to accept the possibility of change. You know, when they understand that maybe I have broken a couple of those Ten Commandments, you know.
We all have, haven't we?
Well, we all have, but you know, it's not everybody that you're ever going to encounter that could tell you that there is not one of them that I haven't fractured or shattered. And yeah, I want to not do that. And it's not because I'm afraid of punishment, and it's not because I fear God. It's because I have no desire to do that. I make a choice here, my choice, of my own free will.
You're not telling us you're like the Zodiac Killer, right?
No.
Okay, all right. Just checking.
No. And I can tell you there's some horrible thing. You know, some people's imaginations will go wild, and I'll tell you, look, I'm not, I haven't, like, done every horrible thing possible at all on the planet. I've never been a sexual predator of any kind, okay?
That's a plus, though, you know?
I, outside of my childhood, I didn't never harmed a child, okay?
Yeah.
When I was a child, they were my peers, and some of them got harmed. But as an adult, never. You know, well, what else awful is usually at the tops of people's lists, right? You know, have you ever gotten violent with a woman? Yes, I have. It is rare. It is a very rare thing that has occurred. But circumstantially, not the aggressor.
Right.
But have I gotten violent with a woman? I have. You know. So, I mean, there's other awful things, I guess. You know, have I stolen? Yes, plenty. Have I lied? Lots. Have I cheated individuals? A false witness against my neighbors? Yes. You know, all the rules involving God? Yes. Adultery? Coveting? Yes, name it. Go ahead.
Well, people get lost in stuff, and what they get lost in is, like, I don't want to say like I had a unique take on the Bible or something, but I was interested in Jesus, not about all the people who are around him, like, so much. So it was like he forgave everybody. And like when he died on the cross, the thing that I came to understand was it all was piled on there. And what I came to understand about the Old Testament was it's law. And it's like, you know, people think, okay, you know, I obey that and then I'm good. What it's really saying is you can't obey it. Like, you don't obey it. Like, he said, if you're hot or cold, I can deal with you. So what you're describing to me is when you talk, you're hot or cold, you're not lukewarm. You have a point of view that's very strong, and that's, like, spiritually very powerful. Mm. So to me, it was more like, you're all full of it. You know, it's like all of us. And to me, it was very important that the people who tried to kill Jesus were religious people. Like, they were standing there trying to trip him up, you know, and get him. And these were the religious people. So it's very confusing to a human mind when you see the religious people and they, you know, act like God. They dress like God. They wear drapes. They do all these different things. And you get to know them and they're terrible people. So, you know, I mean, I'm talking generally about that type of point of view. I'm not trying to insult anybody who does that. And they try to be a better person. And it somehow does lead them to be like some of the Pharisees. We're good and, you know, we're still afraid and came to saw Jesus at night sometimes. But to me, the thing was, I'm like, he said, if you break one of them, you broke all of them. And we all broke one of them, you know, and many more. So the thing was, he's saying, like, I took it upon myself. And like, people get lost in these terms, like born again, like you say that and you think right away, like a right wing religious movement or something. Yeah. But if you really look at it, it's not left or right. It's really saying, you know, it's really saying you need to be born over, you know, from above. So it's just kind of, that's the way I look at it, is I needed badly to be born over from above. My life was a mess and I still struggle, and it makes me more empathetic and loving to other people. So when somebody starts telling me not how good they are or how, you know, reasons for what they did, but they just come out and say, I did these things, you know, I can identify with that because that's not why I believe in God. I believe in God because I was gone. I was lost. I was finished. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, I don't want to overstate it, but in a certain level, I could have been off the earth and nobody really would care after a few years on one level. And on another level, we've all done things. So what's the answer to it? Obviously, it's not to run around and perform rituals and try to obey 10 commandments, which we can't, you know, follow. Like, you try hard, you break them in 5 minutes. But really, that was taught. If you really read scripture instead of just what people interpret it as, and I don't mean you, I mean in general, me too. Mm-hmm. It's really saying it's a mirror, and when you look at it, you see what a mess you are. And then he's saying, I know you're a mess, but I love you. And, you know, the way we were living leads to death. Like, I could have been dead. I could have done, you know, drunk myself to death or different things before I was even 20. Mm-hmm. So I'll be, you know, fully open about that. I don't do that anymore. I haven't really done it since. But since I was a kid, so we're born in some kind of pain. Yeah. And I think that's where the pain stems from. And so when you talk, I don't get scared. I get like, well, he's being honest, you know, and you put up a religious veneer and you're finished. But it was those people that wanted Jesus dead. And why did they want him dead? Because they're pretenders, you know, like that whole outlook is pretender. And you're talking about a great piece of what I believe is what you're saying. So it's easy for me to find common ground with you right away. And it's confusing to me because I hated religious people from the time I was a kid. You know, and I mean by religious, I mean it in the worst possible sense of the word. I think the word, not trying to sound like I read a book, but I think it comes from religarse, which means to go back into bondage. Like, I didn't want to go back into bondage. I wanted to be set free, and I knew I was a mess. So anybody who shares those two things with me, it's easy for me to call them a friend. So I mean that as a compliment.
No, I understand. And, you know, here's the thing about religion and the way that it's used for, you know, the word, the way it's used in the language we're speaking. Anything you do repeatedly is religion. It's just that simple. You can religiously tie your shoes, okay? So religion is a useless word to me. But when people identify themselves as Christian, and they tell me that, you know, obviously the word is the most important thing, you know, and I study the scriptures, I see repeatedly that, you know, regardless of all these laws and regardless of all these things that came before, here's the thing. You accept my way. This is what, you know, a very, very seriously loose paraphrase from several passages where it's, you know, Jesus's words, right? They're the ones in red in some Bibles. It basically, you accept my way, then I am with you, and that is the only thing you need to do. And that's the way I read it, and that's the way I understand Christianity. And I've ministered to people that are Christian, despite the fact that I would not primarily call myself a Christian, because I'm serving.
I can understand that. I mean, I didn't mean to interrupt your flow, but
it's okay.
One thing with me is I don't know everything, you know? Like, it's no shock to some of you, right? Bob doesn't know everything. But I mean, a lot of people think they do know everything, and it's like, I never want to be in a place where I force my belief on someone else,
right.
And I just try to say what happened to me that's diehard, and I'm pretty certain of it, but it's not something I ever really wanted to force on someone.
Mm-hmm.
When I came to that point, I was broken, you know, and you could say, well, he was broken, so he latched on to something. Trust me, it wouldn't have lasted this long when it started when I was about 19. So it's more of a relationship, you know, with a loving creator. And I don't beat myself, you know, up. Like, I've spoken the way you're spoken about things that I've done and these things, and that's powerful, and what you're saying is powerful. But I think it's important, like, one of the most important things you're doing is you're honestly, you know, having the courage to stand naked. And, like, you know, to me, Christ on the cross was naked. It's not an accident. It's not an accident that Adam and Eve were naked, you know, consciousness and... And when they realize that they were fallen, like, whether someone takes that as a myth or whatever, I think it's a literal fact in that you're standing spiritually naked before God. And when you hide and try to cover yourself up, it's because you know something went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that's what happened to me. But I never want to be in a place where I hurt somebody else or I judge somebody else, because if I act like I'm really better than anybody, like, it's a joke, you know, and sometimes you have to catch yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But or you might get zealous because you're trying to show someone something that helped you. But I try to never be in the position where I'm not loving to the other, you know, as flawed as I am. I try to reach out to other people and love other people. And I know the people who helped me were people who treated me that way.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, you know, judgment is of its own. Like, I don't have to bring it. Who am I to judge anybody? You know, I believe there's civil law that keeps order, but there's like a spiritual law. And I know I failed at it miserably. And I know what came to me was Jesus. And I understand, like, before I had that experience, the people who hurt me were often religious people. So I understand that too. But when you talk to somebody who has only been hurt by the religious part, which is pretty extensive, it's all over the place, it's sometimes hard to explain that, you know. And but I think it's very powerful, and it's very tied into what you're doing.
Well, you know, that brings me to one of the things that I actually left out of the introduction, and then I'd like to go head over to Chris. But again, explaining part of the reason why you're here, Bob, is that I know I'm going to get this perspective, and I want it there. The thing is that, okay, I don't have many points of pride. Okay, at all in my life. I don't think very much of myself, generally speaking. That's a truth that annoys the hell out of my current missus. But gotta tell you that I just don't think much of myself. I have no point of pride except one. And that is that I feel as though, first of all, I know, and I don't feel, I know that I am just fine when it comes to being spiritually lawful at this point in time. And I get that sense through a personal connection that I can't explain. And I don't know everything either. But that indeed is not even my full point of pride. My full point of pride is this. I may not live a whole lot much longer. That I'm so certain of. I have no idea how to explain it, but I may not be around much longer at all. I'm surprised I got this far. But the point of pride, once again, is that it is no one man or one thing that was able to kill me. Yeah. And not one, and many attempted. So I think that simply by virtue of that having happened, that I am here for a reason. I have been here for a reason. And if not, then it would have been allowed. I should have not survived many a circumstance. So when I do check out of here, which might not be long from now, and I'm fine with it, I'm not going to do it myself, but I assure you that no one thing, person, or circumstance is going to have done it. It's going to be the cumulative effect of the many attempts and the many little bits and pieces that got taken out of me over time. And I believe that is the thing I'm most proud of, is that, yeah, no matter what the motivation was, the odds, the circumstance, I have continued to survive for a purpose, and I don't even have to know what that purpose is. I'll fulfill it, and I will leave that to what I would call the chief deity. I believe there's more than one, Bob. I know you don't like that necessarily, but I do believe
I'm trying to find things we agree on, which are many, so it's like, yeah, there are catchwords, but like, I think you can tell most of the time when we talk, like, I have a deep respect for you. So it's, you know, when you do the podcast and stuff, you know, even though you're very different than what I do, you're very intelligent. I guess I just said I'm not very intelligent, but that's kind of funny. But it's like, you know, I look at things in a certain way, but I have a deep respect for what you do. And I could see, you know, admitting like my point of view is close to what you just said. But at the same time, I understand why you would be led to see things the way you see things. And it's coming from a place of understanding, trying to deal with it, work it into your everyday life, and be loving towards people, even though you've needed to be tough at times. So like, I understand that. So it's not like I want to fight with you about it. I just know what I felt pulled me out of the sewer, my own sewer, and still does. You know, it's something you got to do every day. So in that sense, I'm nobody to preach at you sometimes, because I feel so strongly I want to say something to you because I mean well for you. But I also know that at the same time, people have to work it out for themselves, and I did too. But the strongest thing that affected me was other people who loved me. And the last thing I thought I would be, in a sense, would be, quote, not just a Christian, because I always was intrigued by Jesus, but put like a, you know, quote, born again Christian or a holy roll. I hope I'm not that, but I don't really identify with that. And, you know, sometimes I piss those people off to no end too, you know, but mm-hmm. the people who are really looking for an answer, the ones who are like-minded in Christianity generally would put up with me and, you know, other people who are searching, I empathize with them. So to me that, you know, Jesus said the greatest thing you can do is basically love your neighbor as yourself, like in whatever way. I think we both try to do that.
Right, right. Well, but the thing,
you know, sometimes I screw up.
No, hey, look, and that's the thing. You're not going to do it perfectly, no matter what your intention is, you know. And that's something I recognize with everybody. But like I said, I see that there is a let's call it an entity at the top of all of it. And I am confident that at certain points, that particular entity, which you would refer to as, you know, God, singular, I would tell you that I don't feel as though I was part of any equation there, except granted that I would have the opportunity to survive if I chose to. And that is the best blessing I was ever given. And I feel as though I've had to be responsible mostly for myself, which again is, you know, a bit against that structure, but you'll find out why it is. I think this way, as we go forward, I'm sure, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, basically God didn't care about me for a long time. And I don't know if he does today.
I think he does. I suspect he definitely does.
But it's okay either way, you understand, because I'm just grateful to have been given the blessing to have the opportunity for a path to survive and to affect what I've been able to affect in my time. And it's a very short time on this earth for everybody. But I've lived twice as long as my father did, and I'm grateful for that. And again, as I pointed out several times, I'm grateful that I've had children, which are very different from me. I thank everything that will accept my thanks that they are different from me, because I've lived kind of a miserable existence mostly. But in the past few years, I've been doing the thing that is right, the thing that I think I was meant to do. And, so I'm grateful for that as well. And, I don't look to wherever it came from. I'm pleased to have received it. But I think it was built over time. And I think, again, that, people who don't understand necessarily the odd points of view and things that they hear from me or some of the stories or whatever and the anecdotes, it's going to fill in all of that nicely, and I think people will begin to understand where the hell this guy comes from. Because that is, frankly, the weirdest question that has reoccurred throughout my entire life, which is I end up in circumstances when I ended up in, like, JFK land with a whole bunch of researchers, you know, these guys who are college professors and everything else. Where the hell did this guy come from? I'm a musician. I'm blind as hell. I'm traveling around with these other guys. I was literally riding with the equipment. You know, and I wasn't very talented, but yet I was out there doing my thing. Where the hell did this guy come from? You know, I'm working, you know, at a gas station. It builds up to I'm working for ExxonMobil. Where the hell did this guy come from? Right? I go into different phases of my life, and ultimately a lot of people go, where did this guy come from?
You were also dressed as a sandwich for Subway, too. Don't leave that out.
Hey, look, dressed as a sandwich, dressed as a Santa Claus at one point. Listen, I got all kinds of credits. You know, so there's a wide variety of things that I did, you know. And so it's, but I think it's an interesting little journey into that part of Invisible America, right? So somebody you introduced to me, Bob, before, because I want to go to Chris. We haven't given Chris a chance to say much.
He'll make up for it. He always gets in there. We trust in Chris.
Hey, look, I definitely want to, but I want to make sure that he's still awake listening to you and me go back and forth. Maybe it's sleepy time.
I hear you.
Anyways, thing is that, you know, Angelia, right? Angelia Bianca. You know, one could say that, that a lot of people would have wrote her the hell off a long time ago.
She's amazing.
Right?
For and, the uninitiated, who exactly is that?
Well, currently she's a very successful anti-violence activist.
Okay.
But, you know, starting out life, you know, she runs away from home. She gets hooked on heroin. She's, you know, go ahead, Bob, fill it in.
Well, yeah, she got, and her dad was, you know, involved in that organization, and he was powerful, and you know, that the organization, you know, what would you call it, the Cosa Nostra, and she could basically go where she wanted and do what she wanted, and she, time after time, you know, got into heavier and heavier drugs, and she, you know, could have lost her life many times. She had went through imprisonment, and, you know, it's to me, it's almost like a truly biblical story where somebody like that, people would write off and the holy people wouldn't want to be seen with her, right? You know, you didn't want to distance yourself from somebody like that in the uglier part of your flesh, but she had a wonderful heart in there, and she did, you know, about everything under the sun, and all of a sudden she had an experience where she wound up not only getting her freedom and learning this from a book, but she was on the streets as like a violence intervention person, where, you know, she was in the middle of people with guns in the ghetto, and they had such respect for her that they cared about what happened to her. So she reached these people, which, you know, speaks to her experience being turned for something like so powerful that these people would trust her and that they would, you know, admire her, you know, and when you could do that in that world, you've really done something. And then she went on even further to be called in before, you know, presidents and, what would you call it, like high councils and different speaking engagements that the normal person would never even be able to attend. So she's like a true story of almost like a Mary Magdalene. And, you know, but she was sunk to the bottom, and it just shows all that was turned for the good. So she's like an amazing, amazing person.
Yeah, I know. I really, I do respect her. I just want to make sure that everyone is on board with her work.
Yeah, no, there's that. There's also the redemptive story of, you know, the guy I bring up who was a friend of mine. I haven't heard from him in years. I hope he's doing well. Generally known as Brother Frank.
Yep.
And, yeah, Frank Minucci is a very cool story. You know,
he never got over that that HBO show, though, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, he was on the Mob Stories thing on HBO. The episode is Getting Out of the Mob. I don't know if people can even find that anymore, but... You know, he was on there. But that guy, you know, was in the world of outlaw bikers and the mob. And if you learn a little bit about his background, you find out that you know, he's sort of like me, in that he's, you know, Irish and Italian anyway, and he's related to actually a fairly famous Irish gangster. And the thing is that, you know, he goes from that and being part of the, well, let's just be blunt, the Hell's Angels hit squad, which is called the Nomads, you know, the guys who are the enforcers for the Hell's Angels, okay? he's part of that and making his way into the Lucchese family, and then decides to turn his life around. And here we go. There's a redemptive story through Christ, actually, Bob. Where he turns around and now he's a motorcycle riding preacher, basically. You know, saving a lot of the other people that, quite frankly, and not like, you know, just preaching to them, by the way, but literally practically saving them from some of the, you know, bad spots they've hit in their lives, drugs, homelessness, this and that. You know, and... really, the amount of people that he scraped up off of the street and turned around is amazing. And he's he gets very little notoriety nowadays or anything like that. Like I said, it was famously the last time he was sort of got a little spotlight is the Robert Blake thing when the Inquirer did a spread on him. But because he called him up and said, "Hey, you know, you know somebody can kill my wife," basically. So
that's illegal.
Courtney Love called him up just prior to that.
This was, I think it was after Courtney. It was well after Kurt and Courtney. But anyway, but there's a guy who was, a feared individual on the street, somebody that, I'll be honest with you, a lot of people were intimidated by before they saw the HBO special in the little town there in Jersey. Totally. But what he actually does and what he ends up doing is a whole different story from the way life started out. And whether I speak to him again in this life or not, I love the man. He's absolutely excellent. I really wanted him to baptize my oldest son and actually wanted him to perform my second marriage. But my future mother-in-law had a different preacher in mind. So,
Protestants, right?
Methodist.
Methodist, yeah.
Yeah, which is actually what literally I was baptized as a Methodist, but that was my father's decision, because he didn't want to have anything else to do with the Catholic Church anymore, although the Methodist Church is kind of under the Catholic Church. All right. Anyways, as I said, but we're going to get into that stuff later in the book. Chris, we've been holding you back all this time and definitely had a bit of a religious discussion, but... religion will play a part in this book for sure. And the inner workings of wondering, am I actually, and things like this might come up. But so what are your thoughts? I mean, I'm sure you'll have a different take on some of this.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, that was a great Marilyn Manson quote at the very beginning. Kudos on that. I also wanted to also say that you very lucky individual when it comes to having help with this psilocybin thing, because based on the limited research that I've done over the years, it does tend to help more than hinder, people with severe issues of varying degrees. So anyway, that aside, I was wondering, were you, as a child, would you call yourself self-aware at a very young age?
Well, what would you call self-aware?
Well, just being, knowing, things that a child probably shouldn't know, just about life in general.
Well, as we're going to discover in, chapter one, a little preview here. Up until the age of four, I had a whole different world in front of me.
Yeah.
And I'm going to describe that, even though it's not actually part of my firsthand account. It's what I had to assemble. But I'll get into that, in the first chapter there. I mean, after all, no one remembers being born because your brain's not capable of retaining memory at that point. Right. So I've got to explain that and a few other things until my memory actually kicks in.
Usually around three or four. Yeah.
I was one of those kids more on the early periphery. Like mine actually starts, I'm probably about a year and a half old. Some kids, they'll tell you they don't have memories until they're like six. None of this is unnatural. It's all, about the amount of time. There's literally a physical explanation for this, because of as animals, let's say people, we're not fully neurologically developed when we come out of our mothers. We're just not.
Right.
So part of your neurological makeup is still being formed. So, it's not, we're not like, say, horses, who can get up and walk pretty soon after they come out.
I've seen that.
Yeah. Or even, even puppies, it only takes, a couple of days. They start to try to wander. They start to move around, very, very quickly. They adjust to the outside world. Whereas, human babies, not so much. So obviously I'm going to have to fill in with a little bit of hearsay to tell part of the story, which I think is relevant. But was I self-aware? there's a big weird difference there. Once a key event occurs when I'm 4 years old, the world changes. And
yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about too, but I won't say anything just to.
Well, it's okay. But the thing is that once that happens, I'm suddenly aware of a great many things, but not as much as. You know, looking back, I say to myself, I really wasn't as, you know, forwardly aware of what I should have, you know, understood. But I'm, you know, judging myself the wrong way because it's hard for me to judge the child now that was in the circumstance. But I did pick up knowledge in a lot of ways. People can never explain where I got it from, and neither can I.
That's what I'm saying. I should have, what I meant to say was, do you put any stock into that when they say that someone's an old soul, that kind of thing? That's kind of where I was trying to go with that question.
Yeah, no, I get a sense that is what some people thought of me. Because with very little study, one of the things I did weirdly, and I wasn't sure if I was going to cover this in the book or not. One of the things that I did weirdly for a little while was, I kind of doctored people a bit. I mean, I stitched up wounds and pulled things out of people and did minor things, stopped bleeding on people and things like this.
Without any kind of training.
With like almost no training and very little familiarity with, you know, with
instinct.
Instinctively in a lot of cases. You know, I mean, I did study a few things. I mean, the first thing I remember getting a hold of was a textbook for a nurse that a nurse had left behind at my home would come by. And I was exposed to some other things early on that just taught me. You know, about, let's be frank, about injections, about CPR and stuff like that. I had all that knowledge pretty much by the time I was like 7, 8.
Cauterizing wounds, things like that.
That was a choice I made, around that time on somebody. Yeah. To burn a wound closed because they couldn't go to the emergency room. They were bleeding pretty badly, and I knew how to properly stop a wound which had involved the femoral artery. Where, you know, they might not even made it to the emergency room anyway, the individual.
Who had suffered a pretty big one.
Yeah, who had suffered a fairly nasty knife wound. I was quick enough to extract part of the knife. I mean, it took magnifying glasses and assistance, but yeah. But it's my hands that extracted piece, you know, like say a piece of a knife point, you know, cleaned it up enough. And, separately you stop the femoral artery from the rest of the flesh wound. The rest of the flesh wound is almost irrelevant, if you can't stop the femoral artery, cause it's just going to pump out. But I knew all that and was able to clamp and stop that. And I had a surviving patient who also didn't get an infection. You know, so what can I say? It was a biker. I don't even remember his name. But
that's all you need to say.
You know, it was a guy who got himself into a situation and didn't want to be seen in public because he was probably going to go to jail if he did. So he didn't want to go to the emergency room. And yeah, I was able to do that. And I have no idea where part of that knowledge came from.
All right, fair enough. Yeah. Well, here's my other question to you. Did you ever experience like the feeling of, this is going to sound weird, and coming from me, I know that's a shocker. When I was a child, and all the way up through most of my life, actually, I always kind of felt like my whole life story was almost like a movie-like, or like an ongoing TV show that just, you know, didn't have credits or anything. Have you had a similar... not that people are actually watching you. I don't mean like a paranoia thing, but just your own reality seeming like it's got this cinematic quality to it.
No, I never had that sensation. I got to be honest. Yeah, I mean,
not many people do. So I was just curious about that.
No, I more often than not felt profoundly alone more than anything.
Yeah, me too.
So I never felt like I was the subject. Matter of fact, I really, as I said before, I don't know if I said it during this now, but as I've said many times, I feel like I lived in a part of the world that was almost invisible to most people. So really, I felt more invisible. And honestly, there was safety in that. You know, the less they notice you, the less likely they are to attack you, you know. So I always took comfort in that, actually. Good. Nobody cares. Nobody notices. Nobody sees me. Good.
Keep your nose clean and you'll be all right. That kind of thing.
Well, you know, just look, the longer you can stay out of the line of sight, the longer you can avoid being the victim of a predator.
Exactly.
You know, and so it was defensive. Not fear, by the way, but lost
in survival instinct.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of lost my taste for fear a long time ago. It's very, very weird. I know what you're getting at, though, and sometimes, I mean, I did, though, in recent years when I started to, like, well, let me tell you some stories then, because somebody would go, well, that's like, you know, you couldn't possibly understand this. And I go, yeah, I can. And if you hang around me a little while, you go, wait a minute, it seems like you can understand a little bit of everything. And I go, well, I got a reason for that. You know, and I started to explain some of this stuff, and then people started saying to me, you know, man, you know, this ought to be a book, or this ought to be a movie, or, yeah. And I kind of was like, I didn't think it would. You might feel as though maybe it's like a cinematic thing, or somebody else might, when my life is like a movie.
Well, for me, it was always like, I was like the, I was like an extra. It's going to sound really weird, but, I always felt like I was a background extra in my own life's story. Kind of like a ignored kind of deal, you know, not in like a, oh, pity me kind of thing, but just like sometimes you feel like you're not exactly the focus of one's own life, if that makes any sense, which I just confused myself. So there you go.
Okay. Well, you know, to me, it's more like, I don't think anybody would ever want to watch anything I'm involved in anyway. So I wouldn't even be up to the level of being the background character in a story. You know, it's like, if my life was a movie, I almost,
you're the key grip.
Well, I feel like it would have, you know, been one of those things that was on VHS that nobody ever bothered to look at. You know, and ended up in the bin collecting dust, and is still in somebody's videotape bin somewhere, unsold. Because nobody wants to watch it. Nobody wants to see this. You know, kind of.
What
like,
was the linchpin moment for you to want to tell your story and try to change people's lives for the better?
Well, it's just a progressive thing that started happening, because I'm telling little stories, and I do this like on almost all of my shows, right? Where I'll say, you know, I know about this, or I'd go, well, you know, I did this, and I throw a little story in, and many different listeners over the years, I want to hear more about that, you know, whatever it is.
But you only have a certain amount of time every night to be able to do that.
Yeah. I'm not the star of the show. I'm just throwing it in there to... here's a little fourth wall break. I'm throwing it in there to put the guest at ease, usually. Like, look, I can relate to what it is. I mean, it does occur to me at that moment where it's like ping, it just kind of comes up in my mind. And then what I'm doing is throwing it in so that there is...
enhancing the conversation.
Yeah, but it's meant to be like a thing to comfort the guest. Like, I can relate to what it is you're talking about specifically, right?
Right, yeah.
And to kind of just make it more personal, because I'm having a conversation. I'm not doing an interview. So I'm trying to set them a little more at ease. They're not just telling the story to the computer screen. The voice coming back at them is telling them, well, look, I can share in this with you a little bit. So... Yeah. You know, and that's led to some people going, well, I understand you then, you know, because, and then they wind up telling me something they wouldn't have said otherwise. Like, You know, the Hank Harrison interview, for instance. Yes. He said some things, and I said some things back during that interview, and it was very strange because I was totally off balance the whole interview with Hank.
I ended up listening to that. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, and I, like, you can hear at certain points, I'm like, I don't know what to say to you.
You said that, yeah, multiple times.
And
it was great.
And that was my honest answer to him, but. Anyway, I said a couple of things to him, and he talked to me afterwards. And it was like, you know, I discovered this is one of his, you know, like, I've always seen him from a distance, so that's the only time I actually interviewed him. But yeah. I discovered that he was like, I like you. You know, you have a the couple of things you said, well, this, you know, and he went off on these different things that he didn't say on the show. That I kind
of
wish
he always struck me as the type of guy that just wanted to peddle his book and then screw after the moment you're off the air. But he was actually pretty friendly with you, huh?
Yeah, there was a follow through, and quite frankly, he left a voicemail for me, and I'm notorious for not getting my voicemails or getting them 2 months later. So I just want you to know that if you ever leave me a voicemail, don't expect me to respond to it. I'm just I don't. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
I'm like that too.
Awful. If you text me or, you know, you try and call me, I don't answer the phone, that's for sure. But you text me or you send me a message through the right things, I respond right away. But when it comes to, he left me a voicemail is the point.
Crucial one too, if I remember right.
Well, not necessarily crucial, but he just said there was things he wanted to tell me about. And this and that, and then I needed to call him back. And here's the thing, I didn't hear it for a little while, and I sent an email over to his office there, and I got back that he had passed.
He died. Yep.
And I was just like, okay. You know, like, I kind of, and he was calling me that night right after the show, and I was just, I don't know, I had a headache or whatever, so I walked away from the computer. But he was like calling me right back on the Skype line, and I was just like, and sometimes I'll take those calls and talk to people afterwards. But anyway, the point is, it just turns out that he just decided that he liked me a bit and really wanted to talk to me, I think. And when I just recently went to a Zoom thing for his celebration of life. And like, they were talking about this kind of trait of his that he would just decide he liked somebody or whatever. But meanwhile, I'm just telling you that I would throw these things in as a way to relate to the guest or a way to relate to the story. And people would say, well, I want to hear more about that. You know, you were a musician. You did that. You opened for that guy. You know, okay, so that's kind of interesting, but whatever.
Your brother invented this and that.
Well, you know, or how did you know about that, you know? I mean, one of my favorite after-show things was talking to Freeway Ricky Ross, which, you know, as I said recently on air somewhere, that it was kind of fascinating because it was like we were kind of commiserating about how the formula for crack just sort of showed up
simultaneously
all across the country at the same time, and stuff like that. And you know, but either way, that's usually introduced for that. But people started asking, like, well, gee, that's a crazy story. You know, or somebody talks about, well, you know, when someone is actually shot, this and that. And I go, well, I've been shot. And I'll tell you this, you know, this is the way it feels, and this is how it worked for me. So, you know, and have you ever actually seen somebody take a bullet to the head? Oh, just on film? Okay, it's a little different in person. I just want you to know. You know, and it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Maybe we want to hear the story behind that. Okay. Yeah. So I told a couple of stories on the show. Just like spent an hour, you know, giving detailed account about just an incident or something. And, you know, it was sort of like, you gotta write this out and do a book. Okay. So now that's what I'm doing, because it seems to be interesting, and I thought it could serve a greater purpose if, you know, I mean, a lot of people have written their memoir and whatever, and, I guess this would be a memoir. But I'm hoping that it basically just has the general message of do not surrender, regardless of how much pain you're in or how insurmountable a circumstance is, everything is only going to occur for a limited time. You don't have to lay down and give up. I mean, all of us are going to die at some point, and we don't have to. In a lot of cases, if we don't want to.
That actually ties into the last thing I was going to bring up. That you feel like, because I can, you know, I can definitely relate. If this is the case, that you have like a feeling that your time is very limited. And that you kind of feel like you have to get this out now, more than ever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would I be correct in that feeling?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I just wanted to be sure because, believe me, I can relate to that big time. So I think what you're doing right now is the right thing.
Well, and I could be wrong, you know, because... Listen, there's more than one point I figured I'm not. I mean, it's much like the predictions of my blindness, where I'd be totally blind. And they said, well, you know, he's probably going to be blind by the time he's 7. Okay, he's probably going to be totally blind by the time he's 14. I know I'm dividing by sevens here, but yeah, that's kind of the way it went. And
that's when all of our cells in our body replenishes itself too, so that kind of makes sense in a way.
Oh yeah, but the condition I started out with was rare, and other people might have actually lost their vision entirely, and I have no idea why I haven't. I still have, you know, just that little bit that I pretty much always had. It went down for a couple of years, but has basically stabilized, and they thought I'd be blind by the time I was 30, and then they stopped predicting. So here I am at 50, I still have my sight. Another interesting thing is that it's almost 10 years ago that doctors indicated to me that I had ALS.
Yeah.
And that, in case people don't know what I'm abbreviating here, I mean, look, I forget the full name, but it's generally called Lou Gehrig's disease. Yep. And, you know, a 3-year... trajectory on that is probably normal, and you basically slowly succumb and get paralyzed and suffocate because your lungs won't even function. That is, and there is no cure, and you're a walking dead man if you have it.
Right.
I pretty much looked at a doctor, and it was around the beginning of 2012, and said no. And left. You know, we can do some more tests.
A lot of guessing in a white coat. As
well, we can do some more tests, and we can do that. But you know, because of that, and also due to the fact, I've suffered fair amount of traumatic shots to the head. Yeah. About 9 concussions have been documented. I'm sure there's more. And there's some damage. There's all sorts of things that were supposed to happen with that, and they were happening. Some other physical injuries I've had. I mean, I was starting to cripple up, excuse the phrase. And again, the psilocybin, I stopped walking with the cane. I'm still in pain every day. I have pain every day, which is also how I wound up getting hooked on opiates, which... is really funny because it took me until I was, even though I dealt with drugs like virtually my whole life, took me until my 30s to get hooked. And it was a doctor writing a prescription that got me hooked. Thanks.
Yeah, I was in the hospital a few months ago, and I feel like they were really pushing that oxycodone crap on me. Thank God it didn't hold.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing, is that once trapped by that, even though I had dealt with and cut heroin and stuff at other times in my life, I tried it earlier on, but I was never a habitual user of anything except cigarettes. Yeah. Cigarettes and caffeine are my habitual usages when it comes to chemicals.
Very hard to break.
And in my whole life, I know I should have quit smoking and everything, and I'm not going to. It's just not going to happen. And I accept that, and I also accept that could indeed be the funny thing that, you know, finally gets me. Which, whatever. Not concerned about it. But the thing is that out of all that stuff, though, and all the things I had dealt with, and indeed learning how to expand bundles of dope and learning how to make crack and, you know, and selling speed to people and whatever else, I was never hooked on anything until those pills. And it took me 7 years to get out of that. And, you know, and also when the pills run out, guess what you turn to is the heroin and whatever else you can get your hands on.
Because it's cheaper, apparently.
I mean, at a certain point, I had a special dealer I knew that could get me Suboxone, too. You know, just so I could avoid withdrawal, because withdrawal is hell. And just before I started doing my show live... is when I kicked that. And, you know, so anyway, interesting trajectory. And here's the thing. I'm not claiming victimhood about any of this, by the way.
No. I just want you to know this, though, Chuck, that if you don't reach anyone else, just know that you're helping me in many ways with this, because I'm very much interested in your life story. But I think you do have a lot of lessons to impart, and that might actually help me with my current situation. So I just wanted to let you know that, and whatever else Bob, you know, you and Bob think of that.
Well, there you have it. Okay. So Bob, I don't know if you have anything else you'd like to add here, but if not, we could always come to a close. Like I said, this will be much more expanded in the future, and we'll have larger audiobook sections. And I think the conversations are going to get more spirited as we go. And we'll also have the option to either add or subtract. I don't know. I don't know how these two guys are going to take everything here. But
Charles Uccelli's private parts.
There you go. But oh, please don't call me Charles.
Sorry.
Oh, you're gonna find out in the book why I say that, indeed.
Chuck Uccelli's private parts.
Yeah, Chuck, I accept if you were an Italian businessman and you called me glasses, that's fine. If you want to,
anyone ever call you Chucky? Like after the doll came out and everything?
Oh yeah, they tried that for a little bit, but.
Doesn't quite work, though.
I'll tell you, one or two girls I let do that. But other than that, not so much.
You're a good guy.
Not so much. I mean, you know, and I used to laugh at it because I think, yeah, I was definitely just going into high school, I think, when that movie first came out.
1988, that's right.
Well, okay, so I was already well into high school, but I had to repeat a year because, well, they wouldn't accept they wouldn't accept my jail school credits, people. You can't.
I can't wait for this book, Chuck.
Well, you know, when you're in when juvenile detention, they still make you go to school in some of them. You know that? That's you know. But then when your high school won't accept the credits from it, you gotta do an extra year when you want to graduate, and it's like, well, I'll just go to night school. No. So I graduated in 1991. I should have graduated in 1990. Anyways, so I was already in there in 88 in high school when that movie came out, and it was a thing for a little bit. I met him,
Brad Dourif. Nice guy. Nice fellow.
You go to a lot of those conventions, don't you? Or is this all one?
This is something else. Yeah, my uncle actually knew him through an ex-girlfriend. It was weird. Anyway, Bob, how are you?
I'm good. I thought this was an interesting, worthy effort. It took some turns we didn't anticipate, and I look forward to the future.
And we definitely had to run a little bit of steam out at the beginning to get the show on the road. But one more little comment here is that I don't care what anybody thinks of Jennifer Tilly, boy. I am a fan.
That movie Bounce.
I'm just saying.
She bounced.
I definitely, you know, if anybody doesn't, we're talking Bride of Chucky here. Definitely would not turn her away. All I'm saying.
She was married to Sam Simon of The Simpsons fame, too, before he passed.
Anyway. Yeah, well, look, you know, I can't, I don't have Simpsons money or nothing, but I'm telling you. Jen. Anyways,
both, brother.
yeah. That's one of my weird ones. But anyway, I want to thank Bob Wilson and Chris Graves for doing this with me. It's not a normal Ocelli effect. So it is going to be distributed in the same way. I really do hope that those of you that are interested will contact me, info@ocelli.com or Blind JFK Researcher. Actually, that's the one you should really use, huh? BlindJFKResearcher@gmail.com. Now, that is going to be the contact address to start with, and we're going to release a text which will explain the written way that you can get involved with getting the rest of the audiobook. This part is free, and it will be followed by a discussion with Bob and Chris, hopefully, as we go further in the future. And no editing on any of this. It's going to be raw, exactly as recorded, so mistakes, missteps, and whatnot, and potentially, although this this one was completely safe for work language-wise, the other sections may not be. So be forewarned, it will be loaded with adult content, and I can't even predict all, even though it's supposed to be my life story, I got to tell you, I can't even predict all of what adult content might come up, because I'm not directing these guys in any way, shape, or form as to what it is they are allowed to ask or state or comment on. So I have no idea what's going to happen, especially in the second segments. And if your feedback, if you are going to participate in this, your feedback could also form the future of what is projected here in the book. So, Halfway to Hell.
That title is, once again,
Halfway to Hell is the working title. And, you know what? Who knows? That might even change along the way. And, this again is the rough draft of the audiobook. So, I want to thank you for listening. Again, thanks to Chris Graves. Thanks to Bob Wilson. And, thanks to all of you that, as you well know, you had some part in inspiring the creation of this particular effort. Take care.